You don't come with me. A crazy lady is going to kill your husband.
Even if I believed you, why should I care? When this is done, Jeremy and I are leaving Hurst and this shithole for good.
You must know that this is insane.
It's my only chance.
The clinic in America was your only chance. Did you ever intend to go? Or was it all just a ploy to get the money?
Finally, she turns her head towards me. Her face, in the lamp's illumination, looks frighteningly thin and terrifyingly calm.
Do you know what the remission rate was? 30%. Just 30%.
I'd bet on worse odds.
Did you win?
I don't reply.
Thought not. And I don't want to take that chance. I don't want to die.
We all have to die.
Easy for you to say, when you're not about to.
She blows out smoke.
Do you have any idea what it's like? Closing your eyes every night, wondering if this time will be the last. And some nights you hope it is, because you're scared and in pain. Others, you try to stay awake, to fight it, because you're so terrified of falling into the darkness.
Her eyes find mine. The lamplight gives them a feverish glow.
Ever thought about death? Really thought about it? No feeling, no sound, no touch. Not existing. Forever.
No, I think, because we all try not to. That's what living is. Keeping ourselves busy, averting our eyes so we don't have to stare into the abyss. Because it would drive us insane. None of us knows how long we have.
I'm not ready.
It's not your call. We don't get to make the choice.
But what if you could? What if you do?
Not this.
Says you.
She glances towards the tunnel.
We both know what's down there.
Bones, I say, trying to keep my voice steady. That's what is down there. Bones of long-dead people who didn't have drugs and chemo and pain relief, who still believed in God and the devil and miracles. We know better now.
It's not real. Don't fucking patronize me, Joe. You were there. We all were.
Marie, you are ill. You're not thinking properly, please. There is nothing down there that can help you. Nothing. Believe me.
Fine.
She stubs out her cigarette and reaches into the rucksack. She takes out a bottle of vodka and a packet of sleeping tablets.
If you really believe that, then let me go. I'll take these and that will be the end of it. At least I get to make the choice.
I don't reply.
She smiles.
You can't, can you? Because you know. Because of what happened to your sister.
My sister was hurt. She got lost. She came back.
From where?
I swallow the hard lump in my throat.
She didn't die.
She laughs. A horrible, brittle sound, devoid of humour or humanity. And a part of me wonders if she was always like this on the inside.
Or if something changed in her that night when we went down there. Maybe something changed in all of us.
Maybe guilt and regret weren't the only things we brought back.
You don't believe that, she says.
Yes, I do.
Bullshit.
Her mouth twists.
She was dead.
No way she survived that blow. I know because... She breaks off. I freeze. Every nerve ending suddenly humming. Because what?
Nothing. It was nothing.
But that's a lie. It's everything. And suddenly I can see it all again. Annie, in a small crumpled heap. Hurst, a short distance away. The crowbar on the ground. Marie clinging to Hurst's arm. But Marie hadn't been standing there before. She had moved. She was closer. To me. To Annie.
It was you,
I say.
You were the one who hit her. I didn't mean to. I panicked. It was an accident.
You let Hurst take the blame. He covered for you. Protected you.
He loves me.
And now it all makes sense. Why she stayed. Why they married. He loved her. But he also had something over her. She couldn't get away from him. And maybe the swimming pool and the bifold doors helped. Just a bit. Were you really going to leave us down there?
I tried to talk him out of it.
But that's not quite true. I remember her placing her hand on his arm. The look that passed between them. I thought she wanted to help us. But now, I'm not sure. I'm not sure of anything anymore.
And Chris?
I told you where I was meeting him that evening. Did you send Hurst after him? Was that your idea too?
No, it wasn't like that.
You know what Hurst was like. I was scared of him. I recall the bruise around her eye, her right eye. And then I picture Hurst pouring my whiskey. Right-handed. Another chunk of the pedestal crumbles.
He never hit you, did he? Does it matter?
Yes.
Fine. No, he didn't. I'd had a scrap with Angie Gordon after school.
So you lied about that, too.
For fuck's sake, it was 25 years ago. What happened, happened. I can't change it. I wish I could.
She glances at the entrance to the cave.
Please, Joe, just let me go.
I can't.
I'll do anything. I can give you money, whatever you want.
Whatever I want.
Yes.
I think about Hurst bleeding to death in the dirt. I think about the money I owe. I think about Annie's wide eyes staring out of the window one bright snowy morning and her small crumpled body lying on the cave floor. I think about the explosives I placed in the cave and the mobile detonator in my pocket. I look at Marie. Hatred burns bright. You can tell me something. I say.
Anything?
Where are all the fucking snowmen? She opens her mouth. The side of her head collapses. Bone, blood, and brain matter explode into the air and rain down like confetti. Her skull is an open crater, bone torn apart like papier-mâché. Her eyes barely widen in surprise. It is too sudden for that. There is no moment of reckoning or understanding. One minute she is alive. The next she is dead, folding to the ground in an ungainly pile, like someone pulled the switch, cut the power. Off.
Jesus Christ!
I spin around. Gloria stands behind me, holding the gun.
You killed her. She wasn't going to give you anything. I've dealt with bitches like her before.
Where's Hurst?
Turns out he was a fast bleeder.
Hurst? Dead.
I try to comprehend this.
For years, I thought I wanted him dead. Wished for it, even. But standing here, I don't feel anything. Except sick and tired. And scared. Because now it's just me and Gloria.
You didn't have to let him die. Afraid I did. But look on the bright side. I have two extra bodies to dispose of, so I really don't have time to kill you slowly.
She points the gun at me.
Any last words?
Don't shoot me.
I wish.
There's no point begging. Nor with Gloria. I could try. I could tell her that I'm a teacher. Teachers do not get shot. We're not that interesting. We die slowly, several years after people presume we're already dead. I could tell her I have another plan. I could tell her I want to run away with her. I could tell her I'm not ready. It won't make any difference. I shut my eyes. The gun cocks.
Hope you're wearing your boogie shoes.
I close my hand around the mobile handset and press call. Not a rumble this time. A roar. It bellows up from the earth and shakes the ground I'm standing on. I open my eyes. I see Gloria stumble, the gun waver. Have I got time to run? Charge her. She looks back up. The gun steadies. Her finger tightens on the trigger.
No reprieve. No last-minute escape. No second chance.
Gloria drops through the ground. Like a rabbit down a hole. A penny down a well. Not even a scream. Gone. Vanished. I stare in shock at the spot where she was standing. At the sinkhole that has just opened in the earth. I limp over. I can just see a glimmer of pink, a strand of blonde hair. The ground shakes again. Soil and grass start to fall away beneath the toes of my trainers. I stagger backwards. Just in time, as the sides of the hole fold in and more gravel, earth and rocks pile on top of her body. I peer into the deep chasm, feeling dazed and sick. My vision falters. Something warm trickles down my cheek, past my ear. My head hurts. I raise a hand to touch it. The area above my eye feels sticky and strangely soft. I don't have time to dwell on it. There's another growl from below. A warning. I need to get out of here before I join Gloria. Down there, in the darkness, among the bones of the dead, and other things. It seems to take a long time to make my way back. My balance is off. I stagger and sway over the inclines and descents. Several times I fall. There's a ringing in my left ear, and one eye doesn't want to focus properly. This isn't good. Not good at all. I'm almost at the old colliery gates when I feel the final aftershock rumble through the ground. I stop and glance back. Black smoke mingles with the charcoal sky. Something falls on my face. It feels like flakes of snow. It takes me a moment to realize that the flakes are black, not white. Flakes of coal. I stand for a second or two and let them fall around me. And then I sit down. This is not a conscious decision. My legs simply give way, like the instructions from my brain have stopped working. Clocked off for the night. Maybe for good. I'm tired. My left eye is clouded with red. It occurs to me that I might not get up again. I don't care.
I lie back on the stony ground. I stare up at the sky, but it feels like I'm staring down into a deep black hole. The darkness tugs at me. Someone grabs my arm. 37. 2 weeks later.
I'm not big on emotional goodbyes.
Me neither.
Should we hug?
Do you want to? Beth gives me a look.
Not really.
Me neither.
You know what people say about hugs? She says.
What?
Just an excuse to hide your face.
Well, for some people that's probably a good thing.
Screw you.
Missed your chance. I'll get over it. And I thought you were drowning your sorrows. Beth raises her glass towards me.
Cheers.
I click my Coke against her pint.
And don't think just because you are pissing off and leaving me to deal with the fallout that I'm buying all night, she says.
By the fallout, I presume you mean your new position as deputy head.
Yeah, well, you know, tomato, tomato.
Tomato. She gives me the finger. Harry resigned a few days ago, along with Simon Saunders. I can't be sure, but I think it probably has something to do with some emails the police found on Stephen Hurst's computer that showed evidence of bribery and corruption. Undue influence on Harry and payments to Simon Saunders in exchange for doctoring his son's coursework. All very unfortunate. Miss Hardy, Susan, history, has taken the role of acting head, and she has appointed Beth as her deputy. I think they will make a good team. In fact, if I were an optimist, I might go even further and say that I think they could really turn Arnhill Academy around. Especially as it looks likely that one of its major problems, Jeremy Hurst, will not be returning. Currently, he is living with foster carers and being counselled by a psychiatrist. He is in shock after the sudden, violent deaths of his parents. I would like to say that I feel sorry for Jeremy, but then I remember Benjamin Morton. I'll never know for certain, but I believe Jeremy took him to the cave. Maybe a joke, maybe an initiation, whatever. Something happened to Ben down there. Something bad. And maybe he wasn't the first. I think about Beth's niece, Emily. Another child who changed. Another life cut tragically short. And Jeremy didn't tell anyone. Except, maybe, his mother. Hurst's and Marie's bodies were found on the old colliery site. Police are still investigating the circumstances of their deaths. Hurst had some questionable associates and more than his fair share of enemies, not to mention a holdall containing a blood-stained crowbar in his boot. So getting to the bottom of it all may take some time. I have a feeling, without any further information, they may never really solve this one. The sinkhole is due to be filled in very soon. The country park scheme is under review. Houses will never be built on the land. No council will ever approve it. The police came to talk to me, of course. PC Taylor and another large, very large sergeant, DC Gary Barnes. They could place me in Hurst's car, which I admitted. I told them he'd given me a lift home one night. However, once that had been ticked off, the questions seemed perfunctory. So, I'm not under suspicion? I asked as they left. Taylor cocked an eyebrow. Not for this. The large sergeant guffawed. Police humour. This looks like a professional job, he said. I don't have you down as the hitman type. I could have told them that there are all types of hitmen. And women. But I didn't. I smiled. The pen is mightier, I said. He stared at me. Teacher humour.
Beth eyes my coke suspiciously. Do you really need to leave today? It's not much of a goodbye drink. We could order a bottle of wine, make an afternoon of it.
I stare at her.
I'm going to miss staring at her. And I'm glad we have made our amends. I told her that the reason I came back to Arnhill was because I blamed Hurst for Chris's suicide. I needed to lay some ghosts to rest.
Partly true.
Most lies are. Sometimes it's enough.
Appealing as that is, I say, I have to go. Anyway, it's the company that's important.
She pulls a face.
Smooth. I'm going for a wee.
She sashays away from the table. I watch her slim figure depart. She is clad in black skinny jeans, DMs and a baggy striped jumper, riddled with holes, which I presume is a fashion statement and not the work of over-enthusiastic moths. I feel a small tug of regret. I like Beth. A lot. And I could almost dare to entertain the notion that she likes me back. She's a good person. But I am not. Which is why I'm leaving. And getting as far away from her as possible.
Ball of chips to share.
I glance up. Lauren plonks an overflowing bowl down on the table. I smile. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Not just for the chips. She stares at me. I remember, I say. It was you who found me up at the pit that night. The moment stretches. Just when I think she's going to remain silent, she says,
I was taking the dog for his last walk.
An old dog, I think. A mum's. A dog with a chunk of fur missing from around its neck, and a tendency to bite. Well, thank you again, I say, for getting me home, for not saying anything, and for everything else. I'm a little hazy on the details.
I didn't do much.
I don't think that's true. She shrugs.
How's your head?
I raise a hand and touch my forehead. There's a small red mark on my temple, and it feels a little tender, like the remains of a bruise. But that's all. I guess I must have hit it when I fell.
You didn't fall.
I didn't.
Not all the way.
She turns and stalks back to the bar. I stare after her. Beth sits back down at the table.
Did you say something?
No. Nothing. I pick up a sachet of sauce.
Ketchup?
Thanks. She takes it, then says,
Oh, before I forget.
She reaches into her bag and slides a small shoebox across the table.
You got it. Mrs. Craddock in biology got it.
Thanks. I open the box and peer inside.
Meet Fluffball,
she says. She didn't, you know.
No. Natural causes.
Good. Thanks.
Don't suppose you're going to enlighten me?
No.
Man of mystery.
Don't forget, international.
I'm going to miss you.
I smile. Me too.
Now can you put that away? It's putting me off my food.
I slip the box into my satchel.
Better? I meant your stupid smile.
It's gone 3 by the time I climb into my car for the drive back to the northwest. Beth and I exchange numbers and promise to stay in touch. I don't know that we probably won't, because we are not the type of people to be text buddies. But that's okay, too. There is no hug. There are no tears and no last-minute lustful romantic kiss. She does not run after the car as I drive down the street. She gives me 2 fingers in the rear-view mirror, then disappears back inside the pub. It's all good. I pull off the high street, but I do not go far. I reach the end of the road, and then I stop beside St. Jude's. I climb out of the car and push the gate open. She is sitting on the rickety wooden bench. She looks composed, in a plain grey jacket and blue dress. As I approach, she turns.
"Strange place to meet for a farewell,"
Miss Grayson says. "But appropriate," I thought.
"I suppose so."
We stare out over the graveyard. "She's not buried here, is she?" I say.
"Who?"
"But she knows."
"Your sister." "This churchyard hasn't been used for a long time."
"She's not buried at any cemeteries nearby. I checked."
"My parents had her cremated."
"No record of her at the crematorium either. In fact, there's no record of her death at all." A long pause. Then she says,
"To lose a child, the pain is unimaginable. I think grief is a type of madness. It can make you do things you would never, under normal circumstances, ever consider."
"What happened to her?" I ask.
"My parents took her away one night. They never brought her back. Or, at least, they never brought her home."
"That's why you were so interested in the history of Arnhill and the pit. Why you said you knew what had happened to Annie." She nods, then asks,
"Was the car crash really an accident?"
"Yes," I say. "It was." She looks thoughtful.
"People say that life finds a way. Perhaps, sometimes, death does too."
And ultimately, I think, he holds all the cards. "I should get going." I hold out a hand. "Goodbye, Miss Grayson." She takes it in her cool, smooth palm.
"Goodbye, Mr. Thorne."
I stand and walk away. I'm almost at the gate when she calls out,
"Joe."
"Yes?"
"Thank you for returning."
I shrug. "Sometimes you don't have a choice." 38. The winding country lanes are dark. I negotiate them slowly and carefully. Even at my snail's pace, the journey takes less time than I expected. I've missed the rush hour traffic and my mind is busy. Too busy. I pull up on a side street a few doors down from the flat I shared with Brendan. I climb out and look up and down. I walk right to the end of the road before I find it. A slightly battered Ford Focus, two child seats in the back, and a sign in the rear window that reads, "Little Monsters on Board." I stare at it for a while, and then I walk more slowly across the road and down two more streets to my old local. A good local. They do a mean steak and kidney pie. I push open the door and spot him right away, at our usual table in the far corner. I order a beer and a packet of crisps and stroll over. He looks up. A grin spreads across his craggy face. "Well, look what the cat dragged in." I put my beer down on the table. He stands and holds open his arms. We hug. He cannot see my face. Finally, we sit. Brendan raises his glass of orange juice.
"Glad to have you back. And in one piece."
I take a sip of my pint. "Thanks. Now, are you going to tell me what the feck happened?" "The blonde woman won't be a problem anymore."
"No?"
"She's dead. An accident. I watch him. But he's good."
"And what about your debt?"
"I think that will be written off very soon."
"Well,
You know what my dear old mammy would say?
What's that?
A wise man never counts his chickens until he's killed the last fox.
Meaning?
You might have taken care of the woman, but do you really think that's the end of it? I open the packet of crisps and offer it to Brendan. He pats his stomach and shakes his head. Diet, remember?
Ah,
of course. You used to be a lot bigger, didn't you?
When you drank.
He grins. Not like the Adonis I am now.
So you'd say you were fat back then?
The grin fades. What is this, Joe?
Something Gloria said before she died. It was quick, if you're wondering. I know you two were close.
Close? I have no bloody idea what you're talking about. I'm your friend. The one who has always been there for you. The one who visited you for weeks in hospital.
You visited me twice. But I guess you were too busy running your businesses. Gambling, extortion, murder.
Businesses? This is Brendan you're talking to?
No. This is the fat man I'm talking to.
We stare at each other.
I see him realize it is no good. All the cards have been played. He holds out his arms.
Fuck. You got me. Always wear sharp. That's why I like you.
The thick Irish brogue has fallen away, like a snake shedding its skin. That's why you got Gloria to cripple me, I say.
Business is business. Friendship is friendship.
What do you know about friendship?
You're still breathing. I'd call that friendship.
Why? Why pretend to be my friend at all? Why let me share your flat?
I was trying to help you. Give you a chance to pay. But you kept getting yourself in deeper. Also, God's honest truth, I enjoy your company. In my position, you don't have many close friends.
Tend to have a lot of accidents, do they?
He chuckles. Sometimes it's necessary.
Necessary?
Of course.
He leans back in his chair.
So, tell me, what did Gloria say?
Hope you're wearing your boogie shoes. It didn't register at the time, what with her pointing a gun at my head. But later, I remembered. He shakes his scruffy head.
Should have known my words of wisdom would come back to haunt me one day.
It wasn't just that. I could almost have dismissed what Gloria said. And I wanted to. I so badly wanted to. But there was something else. It was the car, I say.
Car?
I saw a black Ford Focus with child seats parked at the B&B before you said you drove down to bring me the bag. It was familiar, but I couldn't quite place it. Then I remembered. I'd seen the same Ford Focus outside the flat once before. You told me it was your sister's car that you'd borrowed.
Ah.
Is it?
Actually, no. Always hide in plain sight, my friend. Half the people in this pub have heard of the fat man. Not one knows his in ear most nights. No one looks twice at Brendan. Reformed drunkster. Harmless Irish buffoon. Same with a car. Nobody notices another kiddie carrier. Something bad happens, you need to get out fast. The police won't stop the scruffy-looking dad trundling along in his Ford Focus to pick up the kids. Perfect disguise.
Or maybe not.
Well, we all make mistakes. Yours was coming back here. Because now, I have a dilemma. You still owe me money. My girlfriend is dead. What am I supposed to do with you, Joe?
Let me walk out of here.
He laughs. I could do that. But it would only be delaying the inevitable.
You're not going to kill me.
And why is that?
Tell me two things first. Why did you tell me to go to the police? Because I knew you wouldn't. Reverse psychology. And was everything lies? Everything else you told me? He considers.
Well, let me see. My mammy is Irish, but not so dear. I did used to be fat. I'm a recovering alcoholic. Oh, and I have a sister.
With two kids, Daisy and Theo. He stares at me. A nerve twitches by his eye. They live in Altrincham. Their dad works at the airport. Mum is a receptionist at the doctor's surgery. Daisy and Theo attend Huntingdon Primary School. Your sister fetches them 3 days a week, and a childminder picks them up on Tuesdays and Fridays when she works late. Oh, also, it isn't gerbils they have. It's hamsters. I pick up my drink and take a sip. How am I doing so far?
How the hell? I haven't got a job. I had some spare time.
Now, here's the thing. If you come after me, I will come after your sister and her family. A snarl curls at the corner of his lip.
You don't have it in you.
No. I reach into my pocket and pull out something small, brown and furry. I drop the dead hamster into his drink. As your dear old mammy said at the gangbang, you have no feckin' idea what I have in me. Brendan stares at the hamster, then back at me. A smile. His expression changes.
Get out of here. I never want to see your ugly face again.
I push my chair back.
Far, far away, he adds.
I hear Botswana's nice.
Book a one-way ticket. You even send a postcard. You're a dead man. Understand?
I understand. I turn and walk across the pub. I don't look back. And for some reason, I don't limp.
Epilogue. Henry has been told not to play up there. Ever since they moved in, it's all his mum has gone on about. It's dangerous. He could get hurt or lost or fall into a hole in the ground. And he doesn't want to fall into a hole in the ground, does he? Henry doesn't. But then he doesn't always listen to his mum either. Sometimes it's like her words are just a jumble of letters. He hears them, but he doesn't really understand what they mean. Apparently, this is because of his autism. It means he doesn't empathize, feel stuff properly. That's not totally true. People he has difficulty with. Animals, not so much. And places, he can feel those. Like the old pit. He felt that the moment they moved in. Calling to him. Like he was standing next to a room where loads of people were talking. But he couldn't quite make out what they were saying. Henry hasn't told his mum about the voices. There are lots of things he doesn't tell his mum because she worries. She says this a lot. She worries about keeping him safe. She worries that he spends so much time alone. That's why she was so happy when he told her about his new friends. Henry has never had friends before, and he knows his mum worries about this, too. Today, mum is upstairs painting. She's redecorating the cottage. She said magnolia on every wall made her feel like she was living in a tin of semolina. Mum said funny things sometimes. Henry thinks he loves his mum. So he feels a bit guilty when he sneaks out, but not enough to stop himself. That's the problem. Henry doesn't stop to consider how his actions will affect other people, the doctors said. He only lives in the moment. This moment is good. The sun is bright. but not soft, melted butter bright like summer. It's hard bright, winter bright, all sharp around the edges, like it could slice your fingers if you touched it. Henry likes that. He's wrapped in a thick duffel coat, and inside is secure and warm, insulated from the world around him. Henry likes that, too. He walks along the lane until he reaches the start of the security fencing. He knows where there is a gap. He's good at finding ways into places. He squeezes through and looks around. He wonders where his friends are. They usually meet him up here. And then he spots them, as if just thinking about them has made them appear. They wave and walk down the small slope towards him. The girl is about Henry's age. The boy is a bit older, skinny, with blonde hair. Sometimes the girl carries a doll. They amble around the scrubby wasteland together. Occasionally, Henry stops and picks up a bit of rock, an old screw or a piece of metal. He likes collecting things. After a while, he's not sure how long because watches confuse him, he realizes that the sun isn't so hard and bright. It's slipped a long way in the sky. It occurs to Henry that his mum might have stopped painting, and if he isn't home, she'll be worried. "I should go," he says. "Not yet," says the boy. "Stay a bit longer," says the girl. Henry debates. He would like to stay. He can feel that tug on his inside, hear the pit thrumming in his head. But he doesn't want his mum to be unhappy. "No," he says. "I'm going." "Wait," the boy says. His voice is more urgent. "We've got something to show you," says the girl. She touches his arm. Her hand is cold. She's only wearing thin pajamas. The boy has on a t-shirt and shorts. Neither is wearing shoes. It occurs to Henry that this is a bit odd. Then the thought is gone, smothered by the whispering voices. He tries once more. "I really need to go back." The boy smiles. Something black drops from his hair and scuttles away. "You'll come back," he says. "We promise."
This is Richard Armitage. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Hiding Place by C.J. Tudor. This program was directed by Roy McMillan, executive producer James Keat. Text copyright 2019 by C.J. Tudor. Production copyright 2019,
Penguin Books Limited.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.